Hello and welcome back to Cooking the Books with me, Julie Smith, the podcast which takes us through four food moments from the books of our favourite food writers. It's about all of life through the prism of food. And this week we're talking about a book that hasn't even been written yet. Yep, we're popping back to that wonderful night just over a week ago when this year's winner of the Jane Grigson Trust Award for debut food writer was about to be crowned.
Ladies and gentlemen,
Jeremy Lee gathered the great and the good of the food world to hear Chairman Don Sloan announce the nominees. Anna Ansari for the Silk Roads Cookbook, Recipes from Baku to Beijing. Nicola Lamb for Sift, The Elements of Great Baking. And Chris Ewens for Movable Feasts, Paris in 20 Meals.
Ladies and gentlemen, the winner of the Jane Grigson Trust Award for 2024 is Chris Ewens for Movable Feasts.
I caught up with Chris just a week later to find out how I was feeling.
I mean, it's amazing. I'm still incredibly surprised to have won. It's a real kind of like pinch myself.
Award winning is not new to you. And in fact, it's probably why you were on the radar of the publishers in the first place. Tell us about the Bodley Head Prize that you won.
That was actually an essay about demonetization in India and a curry suggested by Rick Stein on his program, Rick Stein's India, and sort of trying to knit those two things together somehow, in which I end up saying that Rick Stein is a god.
Which is kind of what you do, not say that Rick Stein is a god, but it's anthropology, isn't it? That's how you approach food. Food is a way of opening the door to a whole world. And that's what makes your book, well, not that I've read it, of course, because it doesn't exist, but that's what makes the kind of the idea of it really interesting, certainly to the Jane Grigson Trust Awards. What we're going to do here is kind of, you're going to have to lead, because obviously I haven't read it. Normally, as my listeners know, I have read these books from cover to cover, and we go into it in some detail, but you have sent me enough information. So first of all, let's start. Movable Feasts, Paris in 20 Meals. It's a great concept. Already a lot of people who I've told about it are going, this is the book that we want about Paris.
Oh, thank goodness.
Tell us why you decided to do it.
So I've been living in Paris for quite a long time now, and when I moved here, it was very much chasing some sort of like Hemingway like dream. And the first couple of years, I was a total sort of like layabout, kind of like faux Bohemian, hanging out with all the kind of kids who live at Shakespeare and Company bookshop and stuff like that. And then, sort of almost by surprise, after these couple of years, I sort of realized that I'd actually started living in this city. Even then, I think that Paris, I'd say a little bit more than London, is like this city of like real bubbles. I don't think that there's a massive amount of kind of crossover between the kind of various groups who live here. I mean, and anyway, that sort of, it started kind of eating away at me more and more that I didn't know enough about this city. And, you know, food really sort of presented itself to me as the way of doing that. Because, I mean, which is going back further in my life, which is that I grew up kind of in working and sort of living around my family's bakery and tea rooms, which was actually in my family for six generations, if you believe it. But they've sold it now, but it's still got my family name over the door. It's just opposite Kew Gardens, basically.
So, I mean, you decided to explore Paris through its food and really explore it, you know, to the 20 arrondissements. You know, that's going out beyond the, you know, the right and the left bank and going right into areas which are where a lot of people live who have come from all sorts of different areas. And that's what's really interesting about it, isn't it? You know, you used to go from the Congolese exiles to fifth generation Algerians. That's what we want to know. Possibly not necessarily if we're popping over there for a weekend, but, you know, if you want to get a real taste of a place, you want to go to where the people who live there eat.
It is like, absolutely. And I think, though, to be honest, one of the slight surprises of the kind of feedback that I've been getting from this, maybe how little kind of people from abroad really know about Paris, that it is just those like central arrondissements. I mean, the way that the book is laid out is going from the 20th arrondissement down to the first one. So I'm in reverse order. And I mean, I live in the 19th, so I've spent a lot of my time in those first three arrondissements. That just sort of is my Paris to me.
So tell us about the 19th.
I mean, it's great. The 19th is a really interesting arrondissement. I mean, so that being said, I mean, I obviously... I'm discovering things as I go, and I learned a lot about the 19th by doing this, you know, by doing the research for this. It's, I think, the poorest arrondissement in Paris by quite some margin. And historically, I think the most interesting thing about it is that it was the home to the big Paris abattoir, which is now, well, it was in a place which is now Parc de la Villette, which is a kind of huge, you know, public park, essentially. But this was, I think, up until the 1950s or the 1960s, I can't remember precisely, but this was where literally every single bit of meat that came onto the table in Paris would have come as an animal and been kind of like killed and then butchered and then sort of sent around the city. And the entire, I mean, a good portion of the 19th arrondissement was effectively an industry based around this sort of abattoir district.
As with all great cities, like Testaccio is in Rome, is exactly the same. It's the nearest to the abattoir.
The abattoir no longer exists and hasn't done for quite a long time. There are still a few, like, you know, butcher shops around it, like very big, cavernous butcher shops which surround the old abattoir area. Where I think they provide for a lot of restaurants just across Paris because they offer relatively cheap, still quite high quality meat.
So who lives there now? What's the sort of the most dominant immigrant population there?
I don't know. I mean, you know in France how they don't really keep censuses on ethnicity effectively. So that's an interesting thing. Obviously, you can kind of look at country of origin. I can speak purely in terms of restaurants. I mean, I live on a road which is a mini Chinatown, effectively, which is interesting. So Paris has, I guess, you know, four-ish Chinatowns, if I'm including this one, sort of some more. But they're slightly divided into places which are really Vietnamese, Cambodian towns, and the place where I am, which is a sort of like actual Chinese immigrants, and they tend to come from a city in China called Wenzhou. So a lot of the places on my street, I've got, I think, three Chinese butchers, you know, and several Chinese restaurants, and they're all people from Wenzhou province, or Wenzhou, the city, I think. But you know,
the smells must be amazing down your street.
they're pretty good. I mean, we've also got, I mean, there's also a boulangerie. I mean, Paris is, you know, the sort of 15-minute city idea, which Anne Hidalgo, who's the mayor, has really been promoting, this idea that you can effectively get anything that you want within 15 minutes of your house. So, I mean, when I say that there's a lot of Chinese restaurants, there are also North African restaurants. There are classic French bistros. Right across from my house is an excellent boulangerie. And then just sort of like 5 minutes away, less than that walk, is a boulangerie which actually won the best croissant in Paris this year.
Fantastic. Go on, give us the name.
It's called Chez Meunier.
I mean, you know, every time I go to Paris now, I always look on Instagram, you know, for the best places. I crossed the city to get to what was, according to Instagram, the best boulangerie. And they'd actually run out by the time I got there, about 8:30 in the morning. Ridiculous. Your first food moment, Chris, is Aligo. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, that's right.
Now, I don't even know what Aligo is. Do you tell?
I mean, I barely knew what it was when I started writing it. So this is, it's basically the order that I was going to write the book in and what the focus was. So I already knew that I was going to write something about food, or I wanted to write something about food in Paris. And then quite by coincidence, I'd been wandering around. I mean, I'm a very bumbling kind of like bad journalist in many ways. I'm a floater, I think, in the, I sort of, circle people and like listen in and then wait and bide my time and then eventually start talking to people. I'm very bad at being direct.
The anthropologist in you.
I like the idea of that, that it's carefully calculated, but I really don't think it is. It's inborn shyness and awkwardness. But anyway, so I've been actually wandering around Belleville trying to talk to people about, you know, food and things like that, not without any particular aim. And then this is one of these like crazy coincidences, which happens, I guess, when you float around for long enough, that I floated up to this bar called, restaurant called Le Mistral, where I go very regularly. It's one of my favorite like restaurants in Paris, because it's a real piece of like the old city, up sort of at the top of the hill in Belleville. And just like by complete coincidence, these three guys at the bar were just chatting about pretty much what I was like searching for, which was like, what's the most representative dish of, well, of the Belleville area. And they were discussing the history of Belleville and so on and so forth. And I got talking to them. Obviously I was interested. And they were saying, so Belleville in the 20th arrondissement in general, like the 19th, is a real kind of immigrant district. I mean, possibly even more diverse than the 19th. I'm not sure on that. Again, the statistics are hard to find. And they were saying, well, how can you possibly pin it down to just one cuisine for all of like Belleville, all of the 20th? Because like there are, you know, like I say, kind of Chinese people who are living there. There are Vietnamese people. There are North Africans. There are sub-Saharan African people. There's historically a big Jewish population, and so on and so forth. And then the bartender at the Mistral, he got involved, and he said, well, yeah, this is true, but you're forgetting about the original immigrants to Paris who made the first big stamp on Paris's food scene. And he said this was people from the Aveyron, which is obviously a region down in the south of France. And he explained amazingly that like most of what we think of as traditional Parisian bistros and cafes are actually, they were actually founded by people from the Aveyron who came up, I guess, in the 19th century. Originally, they came up because Aveyron was a coal producing area, and they set up coal shops. But then it takes quite a long time to give people coal, and they also bought sort of wine from their home as well, and they would give people a bit of wine while they were waiting for their coal to be unloaded or given to them. And then also they started cooking home-cooked food, and eventually people were coming to these places not to buy coal, but just to buy, you know, get the wine and the food that they were giving. And from this, the first sort of real kind of cafes started to evolve.
So they were for working class people?
Well, yeah, effectively. I guess the first ones, at least, were founded, I guess, the Aveyronese people began to actually sort of set up real cafes. And I have a list somewhere, but I know that, for example, Le Dumago is a famous Aveyronese cafe,
which was the centre of the philosophical sort of, you know, cultural exchange back in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, wasn't it?
That's the one, yeah. And Aligot, which is a dish of combined Tom cheese and potato, sort of, I mean, really, there's a lot of cheese in it. It's about 30% cheese, 70% potato, and it's whipped into like a paste. And that was the sort of Aveyronese dish, which I was suggested would be a representative of the immigrant food of the 20th arrondissement.
So it is an antidote or an alternative to the haute cuisine that we know about. You know, Paris is the gastronomic centre. It was sort of the birth of haute cuisine as we know it. This feels like food for the people. It's absolutely not being set up as anything other than a way of feeding people out of home.
Yeah, absolutely, yes. That's definitely how it would have begun, like this, sharing home-cooked regional cooking with, yeah, ordinary people who are not going to get, you're right, yes, haute cuisine stuff. But then, obviously, I mean, it's in Paris, it's in France, and I think one of the things that I also want to be looking at is the way in which, like, French culture, no matter what level it's, you know, the food is occurring at, there's sort of some of that haute cuisine does penetrate into this basic cafes, I suppose.
That's so interesting. The birth of basically Parisian food culture comes from potato and cheese. your second food moment is kebabs. Again, not necessarily something that we would associate with Parisian food culture, but it is a way into a story about what Paris has become. Why, of all the things you could have told me about this book, did you choose the kebabs?
Partly because it's one of the chapters which I've written so far. I'm about halfway through, so I mean, I didn't have the complete spread.
But you did say you're interested in the dream and the philosophy of Paris cooking and how these things impact at all levels of French culinary society and how they are lived, and you got me at the dream.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, so I wanted to talk about kebabs, I mean, primarily, again, because it's the 19th arrondissement. I'm using them as my way into the 19th arrondissement. But I think something that, is very interesting about food throughout Paris is the way that there are these cues, I feel, from the real kind of haute cuisine of Paris dining, and that kind of trickle all the way down to a kebab store. So I think what I write about in the book, there are two things, which is whenever you get a kebab in France, they'll ask you salad, tomate, onion. So do you want salad, tomato and onion? And I mean, like, you'd just say yes. But it's part of the ritual which exists in a lot of, like, French server-client interactions. You know, when you go into a boulangerie, there's this sort of, I mean, in a lot of boulangeries, there will be this sort of trilling, bonjour, bonjour. And when you order something, it will always, after you've ordered it, they will always say, avec ceci. Like, you know, it's these particular ritualistic ways of interacting, and it's fascinating to find that, you know, in the top tables and in kebab stores. So that was one of those things. And then another one, there are this is more my speculation, but there are an enormous number of sauces which you get on your kebab, and you always be asked likewise kind of quelle sauce, and there are sort of between 12 and 15 sauces all behind the counter. And it's a somewhat of a theory, I mean, that that maybe the kind of obsession with how many sauces they have links again to this idea of sauces being so central to French fine dining and French cuisine.
Yeah. But it's interesting because you dissociate kebabs with certain immigrant populations. Is that the same in Paris, or has it sort of been diluted across lots of different immigrant cultures?
So I suppose when I set out to find out about kebab stores in the area around where I live, my assumption was that most, it would be a kind of pan North African concern. I mean, the largest immigrant population in Paris are obviously people from Morocco, Tunisia, Algeria. But then it turned out that no, in fact, most kebab stores in Paris were founded and are still run by Turkish people. Well, I say most in the 19th of people who I talk to. I haven't got statistics for the whole city.
Really,
so that, you know, it seems that it's genuinely still a Turkish business rather than a North African one.
Fascinating. Your third food moment is Congolese food. But it's also about you being diagnosed with type 1 diabetes quite late in life. Tell me about the confluence of those two ideas.
I mean, so it was slightly more of a coincidence. So, yeah, I did. I got diagnosed with type 1 diabetes just before I turned 30. And I remember, first of all, the doctor telling me, you know, I mean, it's very unlikely that you'll get it this late in life. And then it was like almost nobody develops it after 30. So I thought, like, oh, I missed it by a few months. But and I was rushed to a French hospital just near the Gare du Nord. And just in the same room as me was another guy, a little bit older than me, actually, who had also just developed type 1 or type 2 diabetes. I mean, I wasn't sure, but he was from the Congo. And I mean, like, obviously, my mind immediately went to food and the idea of food, and kind of like panicking. Will I ever be able to eat again? Will I be able to eat the same way that I've been eating before? In short, the answer was yes, but it was still playing a lot on my mind, and I think it was playing a lot on this guy's mind as well, who was in the bed next to me. And so through this kind of week of recuperation when we were being served this incredibly bland French hospital food, which, you know, nevertheless was still aiming towards that kind of like the higher echelons of French food. You know, you were still getting bœuf bourguignon and a cheese course, like, even though it was, you know, terrible, terrible bœuf bourguignon, like rubbery cheese. But, you know, so we had a lot of conversations about food, and he was just talking over and over about this, well, Congolese food in general, and then about this one restaurant in particular in the 18th arrondissement, which he kept saying, oh, when we get out, you know, when we don't have to have this horrible stuff anymore, we have to go there. We have to go there together. And so, I mean, that's sort of how it began, or how my diabetes like led into my exploration of Congolese food.
Did you take him up on it? Have you been there?
Well, no, I have been to the restaurant now. Unfortunately, I think when I came out of the hospital, it was very much this, like, I mean, it was quite a, I'm not deeply traumatic experience, but it was pretty unpleasant. And anyway, I wasn't suddenly desperate to kind of go back and kind of connect with him. And so I did get in touch with him to say, should we go to the restaurant now, about 6 months after the experience, but by which time he had gone back to the Congo.
He opened a door rather than making a long-term friendship.
Yes, yeah.
Your last food moment is about making croissants. It goes right back to the roots of how you got into food in the first place, your family history, and to the heart of possibly most people's experience of Paris. We've been to the 20th and the 19th and a little bit of the 18th arrondissement. Are you going to take us deep into the 5th, the 6th, the 7th?
With the croissant, it's the 17th arrondissement.
You only got to about the 15th as you're going through.
I've got to the 10th now, but I suppose the way that you structure a book slightly is kind of like the first few chapters have more to do with me, basically. So in terms of my food moments, I think I'm sort of introducing the world to who I am through these various foods. And then I think it becomes more journalistic as I go on. And then by the time I get back to the first, I'll try and bring it back to, you know, me again. So, yeah, the croissant, the 17th arrondissement. So, I don't know, I mean, I don't know if you know the 17th arrondissement at all, or if you've been there.
Give me a name, give me a port or a metro station.
Oh, a metro station would be Place de Clichy, I guess. Also, the Batignolles area is really what I'm focusing on here. And the Batignolles is sort of like, it's the centre of... I would almost say the center of gentrification for Paris. Like, this is, you know, in the last maybe 20 years, it has gone from a real working class neighborhood to, just full of sort of wealthy young professionals, all sort of living a kind of half Parisian, half almost American kind of dream. And so what I was reacting against there almost was they all go out and they all have like brunch on a Saturday or a Sunday. And brunch is this massive thing in the Batignolles. You go to the Batignolles. It's a beautiful, beautiful area. It's sort of like it's a great place if you are a tourist, because it looks just like Paris, but there are almost no tourists there. And the food is great because, I mean, I'm not necessarily in favor of gentrification, but like there are a lot of like young, ambitious, bakeries, chefs and what have you in the area. But anyway, I wanted to do something which was a little bit of a resistance against brunch, which I think of as like a bit overpriced and, not particularly difficult to assemble. And so almost the opposite, although it's on a brunch table, is the croissant, which is unbelievably underpriced and extremely difficult to make. So that was the initial idea. And then I have a friend, actually, who works in a bakery, actually just over the border of the 17th and the 18th. And so she invited me in and kind of took me through all of the steps, the sort of laborious task of making a croissant, like step by step and folding pastry over pastry and what have you.
Now, one of the things I asked you about at the Great Jane Grigson Trust Awards just before you learnt that you were the winner was about you have no footprint on Instagram whatsoever, although I noticed you just started over the weekend. I think you have 17 followers or something.
I mean, well, I think I'm up to 35 now, actually. But yeah.
Well, that's in the last hour. Will you be one of those people who will become our guide to Paris? Will we just be putting on in our hashtag Paris food guide and up you come? I can't imagine you wanting to do that, but
I have to say, and this is not maybe the best way of trying to sell this book, but I'm aware that I'm not trying to write necessarily a guide as to where you should go to eat in Paris. What I'm trying to do with this book is just say, actually, like, everywhere across Paris, there are people who are working incredibly hard and incredibly passionately, creating a whole range of different foodstuffs. And you should try out these areas and these cuisines rather than necessarily going to any like particular restaurant. Because, I don't know, I mean, to my mind, like a lot of restaurants in Paris in general, they're quite, I don't want to say samey, but you get... You get a lot of the same sort of stuff, and it's more interesting, I think, to let yourself be guided by, you know, yeah, culture or, and yeah, the people's enthusiasm for, you know, the things that they do.
But it's story, isn't it? I mean, that's what I would be looking for. I don't particularly want to go to the best boulangerie. I want to go to the boulangerie with the best story. In fact, the one I went to was the one where Kitty Tate had worked, because it was a story that we talked about on the episode. And so for me, it's very much about story. You know, is it the kind of book where we're going to be sitting in Les Deux Magots and reading about Paris through its food and its changing philosophy and its changing food culture, but essentially the essence of the Parisian is always going to be the same?
I guess so. That's a tricky question.
You haven't come to any conclusions, have you? Because you haven't written it.
I haven't. No.
You know, that final sentence and then fin. What is it going to say?
And then this is the last word on Paris. I mean, the idea is to present Paris for what it is. There are loads of, like, terrible things going on in the world in general. And I think what's been most inspiring, what I'm learning while I'm doing this book, is just how many people are making good things. And Paris is one of these real centres of people making good things, not necessarily for like huge like outward praise, but more they're wanting to make good things because they want to make good things for the sake of it. That's which I think is epitomised by the croissant, but it's all over the city. There is a unifying aspect among all Parisians in all the cultures that I've spoken to. It's these people who care in craft and artistry for craft and artistry's sake.
Thanks for listening. Do head over to Extra Bites on my Substack to hear the whole of Don's speech about the nominees, the award, and why it matters. And while Anna Ansari is off in China finishing her book, Nicola Lam is coming soon to Cooking the Books. I'll see you next week.